Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, studies show that powerful people feel less empathy. What does that mean for societies? And first, is the war against Iran by Israel and the United States illegal? And what about its targets? Doug Becker explores international law about war.
I'm Doug Becker. The Israeli-American war on Iran continues. On today's show, we wrestle with the question of the war's legality. In doing so, we reject U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth's assertion that the U.S. will fight this war with, quote, no stupid rules of engagement, no politically correct wars, no nation-building quagmire. Now, while he rejects the importance of the rules and laws of war, we do not. So we will ask, is this war legal? Is the manner in which the US and Israel have fought the war legal, with a particular eye towards what's being targeted in these airstrikes? And has Iran's response been legal? Our panel today is Gabor Rona. He is professor of practice at Cardozo Law School. He's the author of Venezuelan Boat Attacks, Utterly Unprecedented and Patently Predictable. Is there a way out of the non-international armed conflict detention dilemma and state responsibility to respect, protect, and fulfill human rights obligations in cyberspace? And Jennifer Trahan, she is clinical professor and director of the Concentration in International Law and Human Rights at NYU's Center for Global Affairs. She is also convener of the Global Institute for the Prevention of Aggression and is the author of Existing Legal Limits to the Use of the Veto in the Face of Atrocity Crimes. And she has a forthcoming book, it's coming out this spring, entitled The Crime of Aggression and Russia's Invasion of Ukraine. Thank you both so very much for joining us. Gabor Rona, I'll start the conversation with you. Is this war legal? And also, in asking this question, what exactly is the legal justification that Israel and the U.S. have made, for the war, and how much does that affect its legality?
Thanks, Doug. Let me first start with, if you don't mind, why do we care about whether it's legal? The United States was perhaps the most important actor in the creation of what we now call the international rules-based order. After the end of the Second World War, we were instrumental in the creation of the United Nations, and the perhaps most significant aspect of this international legal order post-World War II is the UN Charter's prohibition on the use of force between states. This is a fairly new phenomenon in international relations. Before it was illegal to wage aggressive war, of course, there were lots of wars. As a result, states could go to war for any reason or no reason. As a result, the world was a much more dangerous place, much less friendly to human rights, much less friendly to human development. These are all things from which the United States has greatly benefited since the UN Charter came into existence. We're now in danger of killing the goose that laid the golden egg for what became the period of the 20th century in which we've had unprecedented levels of peace, in spite of the fact that there were some war, unprecedented levels of development in human rights respect, unprecedented developments in health, human development, progress in international relations. Virtually all of this depends for its existence on this one aspect of the UN Charter, which prohibits the use of force, prohibits states from engaging in aggression against other states. Now, let me talk for a minute just to directly answer your question, not so much about why this is important now, but exactly what happened here. In order to preserve this international rules-based order, states have not entirely prohibited the use of force, only the use of aggressive force. And in the UN Charter, they've also recognized that states will continue to have a right to use force in self-defense. However, that right is severely limited. It's limited by the question of whether or not a state has, first of all, suffered an attack. If a state has suffered an attack, then it has a right to use force in self-defense. Subsequent jurisprudence has established that while a state doesn't exactly have to wait until it is attacked, it can also use force in self-defense, but only in the extremely limited circumstance when it can prove that an attack on it was imminent. Imminent means imminent. It doesn't mean something that can happen next year. It doesn't mean something that is in a formative stage. It means that the need to use force in self-defense is instant and overwhelming, leaving no choice for alternatives. Those criteria simply do not exist. They do not exist for Israel. They do not exist for the United States in connection with the attacks on Iran. They did not exist in connection with the US attack on Venezuela. They did not exist in the case of Russia's attacks on Ukraine. And all of these violations of the international legal order threaten to simply destroy this post-World War II rules-based order that has been so important and instrumental in the relative degree of peace, international security, health, welfare that we've been able to enjoy in these last few generations.
And we'll delve into the details, but Jennifer Trahan, I want to bring you in because you got a book coming out about the legality of Russia's invasion of Ukraine or illegality of that. Going off of Gabor's comments, then, how much is this war contributing to a sense that these questions are becoming much less relevant and the consequences of that?
I would say they demonstrate how these questions are totally relevant. Gabor has framed it, the UN Charter protects our system of states and state sovereignty. Our bedrock foundational provision is Article 2.4, no aggressive use of force. If that is violated, we are all less secure all around the globe. It's not just a matter for Ukraine or Venezuela or Iran. It is the whole UN Charter system. So it is completely relevant. And what do you do when your violator is a permanent member of the UN Security Council? It poses particular questions, but I completely concur with Gabor's legal analysis. So Article 2.4 says no aggressive use of force. Your only exceptions would be if the Security Council has authorized the intervention. Well, no Security Council authorized any intervention in Iran, right? So that hasn't happened. Allowed is also if a state consents, but Iran did not consent. We have maybe, according to some states, a limited exception called humanitarian intervention. It's really only a very small minority of states that still would make that claim, because it's generally been recognized as supplanted by something we call the responsibility to protect, which requires the Security Council to authorize it. But does it look like the US went into Iran to save the civilians who were being massacred? No, they were massacred largely, we think, in January. So huge numbers massacred then. The US doesn't seem to be framing this in any way as humanitarian intervention. And again, that's a very deeply contested doctrine. So then we're puzzling self-defense. And Gabor is completely right. Was the US about to be imminently attacked? No. Was Israel about to be imminently attacked? So that would be anticipatory self-defense. There was no actual attack. And kind of any broader stretch of the law harkens back to arguments George W. Bush made in going into Iraq that really have been rejected legally. He said, oh, we can't wait till we're imminently about to be attacked. We need to go in before that. And he called that preemptive self-defense. And the world basically responded, no, we have this criteria. We stick with this criteria because the other one is completely elastic. Go in before you're imminently about to be attacked to prevent. And that has been roundly rejected. So none of the legal exceptions apply. This looks like a violation of Article 2.4 of the UN Charter.
Now, Gabor, the U.S. has been inconsistent. The Trump administration has been inconsistent at justifying the attack. But let's presume for a moment that they were consistent and focused on the need for regime change because of the human rights violations by the Iranian regime. Would that be justified under the existing legal structure? Is there a pathway that this could be legal?
Only if the Security Council were to authorize it, Doug. Regime change is not self-defense. Just to follow up what Jennifer said about this alternate justification of humanitarian intervention, which I agree entirely is not roundly accepted under international law. And again, if the Security Council wants to authorize an intervention for humanitarian purposes, it is perfectly capable of doing so, and that would make the intervention legal. But absent Security Council authorization, the answer is no. Regime change is not a legitimate basis. Exhibit A in that regard is that, in fact, the Security Council, we may recall, did authorize military action in Libya, and it was largely in response to the atrocities that were being committed by the Gaddafi regime against his own people. But when the United States effectively changed its operations there from mere peacekeeping or peace enforcing for the purpose of protecting the Libyan population, changed it into regime change. That was outside the scope of the Security Council resolution, and many other states roundly objected to what the United States was doing in Libya, in spite of the fact that there was a Security Council resolution, because the U.S. exceeded its authority under the Security Council resolution. As a consequence of that, states have now become extremely skeptical about efforts to authorize Security Council resolution for humanitarian purposes. Again, to follow up on Jennifer's point, Russia also justified its intervention into Ukraine on humanitarian grounds. It claimed that Ukraine was committing genocide against, Russian ethnics in eastern Ukraine. So it's very easy to see why states would be reluctant and skeptical and would not create an exception to the use of force for humanitarian intervention, at least on a unilateral basis. In other words, requiring Security Council authorization before that can happen.
And Jennifer, this kind of raises the question then about if it's not legal. First of all, how do we gauge that? Because I think one thing Gabor had highlighted that I would want to lay out is states will make cases. Lawyers will make cases in a court. The lawyer is not the jury. The jury is the one who's making the decision about whether it's legal or illegal. So, how do we gauge that? And specifically, my question is, it's one thing to say there was no Security Council resolution that authorized the use of force. Does there need to be either a resolution or at least a discourse at the Security Council declaring a condemnation or a recognition that that's an act of a violation of international law? So the space between permission and condemnation.
I was disappointed to see the resolution yesterday out of the Security Council only denouncing Iranian attacks.
As a quick note, we are recording on Thursday the 12th. So yesterday would have been Wednesday the 11th.
So the Security Council was able to issue a very widely supported resolution condemning Iranian attacks. It was silent on the US and Israel. And I guess that was the only consensus that could be achieved. It's an obviously very incomplete story to have such a one-sided resolution. And I get it, maybe countries didn't want to draft another resolution that would just be instantly vetoed by the US. I would say they should have drafted it and had it vetoed so people could at least see the process and why the condemnation doesn't get out. It happened in the case of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There was a resolution drafted, Of course, Russia vetoed it, but they did go ahead and draft the resolution, try to impose other measures, which broadly shows the problem. Under the UN system, the Security Council has primary responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security. And when your aggressive state is a permanent member, or there is an ally of a permanent member at issue, the whole Chapter 7 system basically doesn't work, which is really problematic, and which is where we are. But I think you asked me, do we have to have condemnation that the US violated the law? We don't have to. No, I would expect it. And I guess they just didn't bother drafting what they knew would be vetoed.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the legality or illegality of Israel and the US's war on Iran and also Iran's response to the war. Our guests are Gabor Rona from Cardozo Law School and Jennifer Trahan from New York University, from NYU. So we've been talking about the legality of the war, what legal scholars will call a jus ad bellum. Is the war legal? I want to get into actually the way the war has been fought. So, Gabor, obviously, news coming out about areas that have been targeted on the first day, the attack on the girls' school. Obviously, targeting a school would be illegal. Was that attack illegal under the rules of law?
I think the answer to that question relies on facts that still have not been made public. I'm not ready to unequivocally say that this was a war crime. Let me explain why. You're absolutely right that it is prohibited to deliberately attack civilians and civilian objects. I don't think there's any indication here yet that the United States deliberately attacked a school. What is more likely is that the United States conducted an attack either with indifference toward whether or not this structure was a legitimate military objective, or they did some due diligence to determine that it was a legitimate military objective, given its proximity to, Iranian revolutionary forces infrastructure right next door, but that due diligence was insufficient. In that event, it's still conceivable that the United States violated its obligations under the law of armed conflict, because that law not only prohibits the purposeful targeting of civilians or civilian infrastructure, it also obligates parties to armed conflict to exercise adequately available precautions in order to assure, to the extent feasible, that only military objectives are being struck. This is a case in which, depending on the reports that you rely on that came out in the last day or so from the New York Times or Washington Post, the indications are, from the military's own investigations, that the military was relying on outdated data concerning the use of that structure, or I should say, and or was relying on the results of artificial intelligence in order to determine what was and was not a legitimate military objective. Those facts, if true, would certainly mean that the United States is not guilty of intentionally targeting civilians, but may still be guilty of a violation of the laws of armed conflict that could constitute a war crime as a result from their failure to take adequate precautions to prevent civilian harm. And this raises the questions about, well, how much diligence is due, which is a particularly novel exercise now with the suddenly available role of artificial intelligence and autonomous weapons in the process of both determining what is targetable and then pushing the button.
And we're going to return back to that. That's a conversation that is going to certainly be ongoing. But Jennifer, I want to highlight then because I think there's been a development in Iran that's actually fairly similar to Russia's targeting in Ukraine. Russia has been targeting the energy infrastructure in Ukraine, and we know that early this week, the Israelis were targeting Iran's energy infrastructure, bombing oil depots, et cetera, and creating quite a bit of ecological damage as a result. Is that generally considered a legitimate target to target an energy infrastructure sort of broadly in fighting the war? Or would that generally, at least, if not specifically, be seen as a war crime?
Generally, those are not permissible targets. If you c would make the case that that oil depot only is providing oil to the military, then you would say that is an appropriate target. If you could make the case, oh, that part of the electric grid is only fueling, allowing military operations, then that, and I don't think electric grids work that way, but that bit of the electric grid would target. Generally, these are civilian objects. Oil, electric grids, they run hospitals, they keep people warm in Ukraine in the middle of winter when they're not being struck. So generally, they're civilian objects. So kind of only in these limited circumstances where they're making an effective contribution to military operations, where the military is using them. Would that convert it to a different use and
Yeah,
be an appropriate target?
and as a quick follow-up, then can you make Iran or Israel sort of made the argument that this is where Iran is making its money and it's using its money to supply organizations that might be attacking Israel? Is that too broad of a definition for a legitimate target?
I think that's too broad of a chain there. So I think it would have to be making an effective contribution to the military operations. In a much more direct way to be a proper target. So then it's a civilian object and it is a war crime to target civilian objects.
And Gabor, you had some thoughts on this as well.
If I could just weigh in on this, there is a terminology that is actually not recognized in the Geneva Conventions or the actual documents on the law of war, but is fairly popular, and that is the concept of dual use. The principles of the law of armed conflict that I was talking about, you have to distinguish between military objectives and civilian objects. And then, even if you've identified a military objective, you have to take precautions to minimize civilian harm. Well, there's a third principle, and that's the principle of proportionality. That means that even if you're targeting a legitimate military objective, if the anticipated civilian harm exceeds the value of taking out that military objective, then you cannot proceed with that targeting. Electric grids, oil facilities, buildings, they may be dual use objects. In that event, it is the obligation of the party that wants to undertake the attack to determine whether the civilian harm is greater than the military advantage. When we're talking about electric grids, when we're talking about essential infrastructure, when we're talking about dangerous forces like dams or nuclear facilities, when we're talking about attacks that inflict potentially severe or permanent harm on the natural environment, it is almost always the case that the principle of proportionality's application leads to the conclusion that these attacks would be disproportionate and therefore prohibited.
So, Jennifer, you made a reference to the Security Council resolution from earlier this week. And I think we would all agree that singling out Iran is problematic from a legal perspective. But that being said, Iran's targeting of its neighbors, the missile strikes, is that legal? Did the Security Council resolution have a point at calling out Iran's actions as illegal?
It is political what they choose to condemn or not. So it is a very, I think, political document that they're only looking at one side. Is Iran is allowed to use self-defense, but in self-defense, of course, is governed by distinction, proportionality, necessity, all the normal rules that would apply. So Iran can target military objects, assets of the US or Israel, for instance, that were used in the attack. It can't target more broadly. So it's not permitted to do any targeting of civilian infrastructure, civilians, and it is not directly the militaries of other Middle Eastern countries that were involved. I mean, if they played some role, and maybe I don't yet fully know the facts. I mean, if you could make the case a Middle Eastern country was operational in assisting, potentially limited targeting, but basically it has to stick to military targets, combatants of the US or Israel, and nothing broader than that.
Gabor, I'd like your thoughts on that same question about Iran's targeting of, the neighbors. I know one of their arguments is that the neighbors, I mean, from a USAID Bellum question, the neighbors, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, UAE, et cetera, their support of the U.S. Military mission, is that enough to justify Iran's attacks?
Well, first, let's distinguish between Iran's attacks on U.S. military facilities in these third countries and Iran's attacks on unrelated civilian infrastructure in these third countries. Any attacks on civilians or civilian infrastructure is a war crime. In the case where those attacks take place against or on the territory of third countries, they are also violations of the prohibition of the use of force in the first place. In other words, the jus ad bellum, the UN Charter. Iran has no business initiating the use of force because it's not in self-defense against Qatar or the Emirates or any place else in the neighborhood. However, the fact is that some of those countries host US military bases. Under the law in armed conflict, the jus in bello, those are legitimate military objectives, but there are still questions, and I have to admit, I'm not sure that there is international legal consensus on the question of whether or not the legitimacy of Iran's attacks on U.S. military forces in third countries is automatically legitimate, or does it depend on whether or not those bases are actively being used in this armed conflict.
And Jennifer, on the same theme about Iran's actions, what about Iran declaring the closure of the Straits of Hormuz and at least threats of attacks against oil tankers that would be going through that? Is there any legal justification for that?
So the Straits of Hormuz legally is supposed to be kept open. I mean, I guess 12 nautical miles from Iran's coastline is its territorial waters, but the Straits of Hormuz are broader than that and should be kept open. Again, Iran could only target legally military vessels, the US or Israel, or again, this very unlikely scenario, if you had an oil tanker and you could prove that oil tanker was only going to give oil to the military, yes, but generally oil tankers would be civilian objects and not permissible targets.
One last question for both of you, and it's the one that I know international legal scholars most dislike about the consequences of the illegality. Obviously, the weakening of a legal structure around the use of force can have broad implications for how often force is used. But specifically, is there any expectation that there's consequences to the US, to Israel, or even, to Iran for these violations of international law, if they have? I'll ask Gabor first, and then Jennifer can finish.
First of all, Doug, if I could provide some context to the question, and then I will answer the question. But the context is that I think we often make a category mistake in using the same concepts that we grew up with from, say, our high school civics classes when it concerns constitutional rights, criminal law, the purposes of punishment. It's a mistake to simply try to transpose those into the international arena. And the reason is that in the domestic realm, you're talking about rules of a single sovereign state. There are police powers, there's enforcement capacity. The way the international political system works is different. It's not just a single sovereignty, it's a whole bunch of sovereign states. States make international law. They decide what should be prohibited. They decide what should be punishable. And they decide what are the limits of the mechanisms of accountability should be. But that doesn't mean that only when you can prosecute somebody for an international crime is the international law working. International law works in many other ways. States impose sanctions against each other. States engage in diplomacy. States engage in either the provision or withholding of foreign assistance. States engage in processes that either, elevate states into positions of authority or turn them into pariah states through various, mechanisms of foreign relations. And all of this serves not just the purpose of punishment, it also serves the purpose of preventing violations, the purpose of deterrence. Now, as to the specific question of what possible consequences there can be, in terms of individual responsibility, the United States, like many other countries, has a war crimes law. Now, we can't expect that the Trump administration and the Trump Justice Department will start investigations of war crimes committed by the United States. We can't expect Iran to do it of itself. But for example, our war crimes law has no statute of limitations. Someday it will no longer be the Trump or Vance administration. And so there is certainly a deterrent effect and a potential for criminal accountability for the violations, of the laws of armed conflict that are taking place today. Now, I'm not holding out hope that that will happen. I'm just saying that there is a mechanism in place. And even if that mechanism fails us, we also have a thing called universal jurisdiction. Universal jurisdiction means that any country can prosecute these violations. It doesn't matter whether the suspect is a national of that country. It doesn't matter whether the crime occurred on the territory of that country. What matters is that all states that are at least parties to the Geneva Conventions are obligated to search for and to either prosecute or extradite individuals who have committed grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. So that provides not only a mechanism for, say, the United States to prosecute its own war criminals, but it creates a mechanism for any country to prosecute any war criminals of any of the states that are involved in such violations of the law of armed conflict today.
And of course, the courts like the International Criminal Court may also have a role to play here. Jennifer, I'm going to give you the last word on that same question.
Yeah, I do think it's very important for states to denounce behavior that they see as inconsistent with the UN Charter. It is a little concerning when Russia invades Ukraine, we have strong denunciation. We have threats to Greenland, strong denunciation. We're seeing a little bit of timidity right now, and all states need to stand up for the UN Charter system. In part for the technical reason, we don't want some argument, oh, there's a new rule on self-defense. We need to denounce this as a breach of the existing rules. Are there costs, consequences in addition to what Gabor mentioned? I think there's reputational cost. When a country goes into an elective war, you look at 9/11, the sympathy of the world was with the US. Going into Afghanistan, I think it was still there. Going into Iraq, we start to lose it, and then we go into a large torture scandal. There are costs of going into elective wars. And in addition to, I think we need to be concerned about a non-functional Security Council when a permanent member is involved. I do have a separate law review article entitled Aggression. And the veto. And maybe we can have a discussion another day about my ideas, legal limits to the veto, that some vetoes are ultra vires. They're not proper exercises of Security Council power. I think that's something we need to explore. And in addition to the war crimes potential prosecutions that Gabor mentioned, we do have this thing called crime of aggression. Now, it hasn't been used since Nuremberg and Tokyo, but it's there in the International Criminal Court's Rome Statute. And this will come maybe as no surprise to your listeners, but it was the US in 2010 in Kampala, Uganda, that limited the court's jurisdiction over that crime so that non-state parties like the US and Russia could not be prosecuted. Well, that is, I guess we see why they've limited that jurisdiction. There is a push to create broader jurisdiction before the International Criminal Court. We had negotiations this past summer. The US came in and threatened every delegate in the room, which is, usually not behavior that we see within UN negotiations. The negotiations were inconclusive, so we continued for 4 more years in this direction. And the idea of the crime of aggression is actually we need to enforce Article 2.4 of the UN Charter. If you look at the definition of the crime in Article 8 bis of the ICC Rome Statute, it enforces Article 2 of the UN Charter. It is trying to make the boundaries of all states safe. And the good news from this summer's negotiations is we had a large number of countries say, yeah, we really do need this. We really don't want to be invaded. We need our boundaries to be protected. And NGOs have gotten behind this initiative as well. As mentioned, it was not yet successful. So that is kind of an additional area that we might be looking into accountability in the future. I have to say, in all reality, the ICC has a non-retroactivity provision, unless there's some creative lawyering, but generally, I think we would not be going back and looking at anything from in this time period. The law generally operates on a going forward basis. But this is something that to be looked for in the future if states and individuals want to support the prohibition against aggressive war contained in the UN Charter.
Well, you're actually kind of reminding me as you lay this out that these aren't decided issues. These are issues that will continue, and the importance of continuing to follow these cases as the dramas unfold. But I will add one additional potential implication for the illegality of the war, and that is popular support for it. The fact that this war is fairly unique and that there hasn't been a rally around the flag effect, and the public opinion polls really are suggesting that Americans are not on board. And though it frequently gets reported as it's the cost of the war or no more forever wars, I think definitely part of that opposition is coming in the form of resistance by saying, this war is illegal and I'm not going to support it. So I think that's an important aspect of that. Gabor, go ahead.
Doug, what you just said also reminds me, not just from a US perspective, from an international perspective, going back to the legality question, the US violates international law by starting this war. Iran has a right to use force in self-defense. As a consequence of these actions, the US has succeeded in turning Iran from its rightful place as a pariah state, not only for its violations of human rights at home, but also abroad, into a victim. And that, I think, has significant implications for the purpose not just of US public opinion, but global public opinion.
We're going to end on that point. Our guests have been Gabor Rona. He is professor of practice at Cardozo Law School. He's the author of Venezuelan Boat Attacks, Utterly Unprecedented and Patently Predictable. And Is There a Way Out of the Non-International Armed Conflict Detention Dilemma? And Jennifer Trahan, she is clinical professor and director of the Concentration in International Law and Human Rights at NYU's Center for Global Affairs. She is also convener of the Global Institute for the Prevention of Aggression and the author of Existing Legal Limits to the Use of the Veto in Face of Atrocity Crimes. And she has a forthcoming book. It's entitled The Crime of Aggression and Russia's Invasion of Ukraine. Thank you both so much for sharing your time and your expertise on this very important topic.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
Our next guest has conducted a study on empathy, which suggests that power blunts our ability or willingness to feel empathy toward others. With us is Dr. Michael Inslick. He is a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto and the author of Stereotype Threat, Theory, Process, and Application. He's co-author of Power Changes, How the Brain Responds to Others. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Michael Inslick. It's great to have you here. Your study explores power and empathy. I thought it would be important to first explore the importance of empathy.
Maybe I should start by thanking you for having me on your show. So I think empathy is an emotion that allows us to connect to other people. And it allows us to kind of understand what they're going through, what they may be experiencing themselves. In a way, it's, you know, sharing the emotions of someone else, maybe trying to put yourself in the shoes of someone else and then kind of understanding, you know, where they're at in a sense, what they may be thinking, what they may be experiencing, and what their intentions are. So it's a very, very valuable process that allows us, well, first of all, to maybe reach out and help people. But it also helps us understand, you know, what people are feeling and doing and thinking. And then we can predict how they're going to act, and then we can act in accordance with how they're going to act. So in a way, it allows us to read their minds. And that's a really, really valuable skill to have.
Your study explored power and empathy, essentially finding that powerful people experienced less empathy using the brain's mirror system. So first of all, what is the mirror system and how did you test this in the lab?
The mirror system essentially is a set of brain regions or networks that seem to be activated when a person, let's say, engages in an action, but also when they watch someone else engage in the same action. Now, this may or may not be related to mirror neurons. So this kind of a famous story of these Italian scientists in the early 90s discovered this class of neurons in macaque monkeys. And more recently, it's been discovered that humans as well have these class of neurons. And these neurons seem, again, to fire when engaging in some sort of motor action, like you're reaching out your hand, for example, but also when observing someone else do that same kind of action. Now, some people have argued, although it is somewhat controversial, that neurons maybe, or maybe more broadly, this kind of mirroring system plays an important role in empathy. Maybe it helps us understand what people are going to do, their intentions, and in a way, it allows us to kind of mentally simulate their actions. And as a result, to understand those actions and for potentially to maybe change our own behaviors as a result of what we predict they'll do. So that's, in a sense, what this mirroring system is. And now you also asked how we assessed this in our study. So really what we did is we used a technology called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is a powerful electromagnet that we kind of hover it over a person's scalp, and we aim it over certain parts of the scalp, which are right on top of the brain, of course, and we aim it on parts of the brain that are related to motor movements. In our case, we aimed it over parts that would enable a person to, let's say, grasp with their hand. So what we do with this, the transcranial magnetic stimulator, or TMS for short, is it depolarizes certain of these brain areas, these motor brain areas, and as a result, one is able to more readily measure kind of spontaneous motor activity in the hand. So I can actually put electrodes on a person's, let's say, muscles of their hand, the muscles that are involved in grasping. And after I kind of applied this magnet, I'll more readily see this kind of spontaneous firing in the hand. Now, the key here is, we have participants in some conditions, we have them watch a video of a hand squeezing a ball. And the typical result is that after TMS application, you find facilitation of these motor potentials or of, you know, the electrical potentials that are responsible for the muscle movement. And this occurs when people are observing a hand relative to when they don't observe a hand. So right there's already evidence that people's brains are mentally simulating these hand movements. And you need this kind of electromagnet in a way to kind of prime the brain in a way so you can measure it in the actual hand. And now for actual study, we took advantage of what we know about TMS and about this motor resonance system. And then we basically evoked different states of power in people by having people write about times in their life when they did or did not experience power. So by power, I mean social power, being responsible for other people, maybe being the boss, making decisions versus being powerless. You know, you are someone that's responsible for you. You are, you know, a subordinate. You kind of do another person's bidding. And we can all remember times when we've been, you know, in a either high in power or low in power. And then we also had a control group where we kind of just asked people to, I think, write about their favorite season. So something neutral, nothing to do with power. And then we had observed these hand movements as we kind of applied this electromagnet. And then we measured the electrical activity over the muscles that are involved in grasping. And what we found was that people who were, you know, primed to remember a time when they were high in power, they showed a marked decrease in resonance. So they didn't tend to mentally simulate the actions of this disembodied hand relative to people who were either in the neutral control group or especially relative to people in the low power group. The people who were, you know, remember the time when they were low in power, they were especially likely to mentally resonate with others, at least as reflected in muscle activity in the hand.
One thing that I think this also suggests is that this is fluid. It's not static. The people who, when they felt power, but in the next moment you could have asked them to recall something that was a time when they weren't feeling powerful.
That's absolutely correct.
This ability to feel empathy for another or to behave empathically would depend on the circumstance in the moment.
Absolutely. So I hope I made clear in the writing of this article that we're not trying to say something, you know, global or you know, trait-like about people high or low in power, because our manipulations, we just took ordinary college students and we had them remember times when they were high or low in power, and they, you know, anyone could have been in any one of those two groups. So you're right. It suggests that this is fluid and that it's maybe not so much an ability or a lack of ability in the case of people who are high in power as it is about motivation. So perhaps if you are high in power, you just, you know, you don't care. You know, you don't care to, you know, mentally simulate the actions of another person because, you know what, I've got the power, I'm responsible, and I'm not reliant necessarily on other people to get what I want. Own power, even situationally, well, now you rely on other people to maybe get what you want, and as a result, it pays for you to pay closer to what they may be feeling, to what they're doing, so that you can predict what they're going to do and then kind of act accordingly. So absolutely, this is a motivated process.
The changes in the brain are not permanent. They are going to change with each situation.
Unless we're talking about extreme cases, so for example, maybe people who suffer from autism, where some people have argued, you know, one of the symptoms may be a lack of empathy or maybe a lack of ability to empathize. So unless we're talking about extreme cases, I think we all have in our capability and ability to get in the head of someone else. And when we do get in the head of someone else, then, you know, we're doing different things in our minds and our brains. So yeah, changes are, you know, again, are very, very fluid. And really, I think it's really helpful to think of this as, you know, do you feel like empathizing with someone? Are you up for it? Or are you, you know, too busy? So this kind of reminds me of a famous quote by Elie Wiesel, who wrote that, you know, the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. So just not caring. When you don't care, you don't engage in those, let's say, the mental operations that you need to get in someone's head and to understand how they're feeling. People, in our study at least, who were primed to be high in power, I suspect, you know, the downstream consequences of the brain responses are a product of, you know, this indifference, of a lack of willingness, maybe, at least in the moment, to kind of mentally simulate other people's actions.
Another of your studies looked at in-group and out-group biases for empathy. How would you say this fits in with your findings here?
In some other lines of work, we have looked as well at this kind of motor resonance system, a system that is thought, at least by some people, to be really important for understanding people's actions and maybe simulating their actions in your own mind and brain, and really thought to be important potentially in empathy. And what we found was that, and again using this time a different brain technique, this is looking at electroencephalography, so EEG, we found that people's ability to kind of mentally resonate is intact, but it is especially heightened when you're resonating with someone who belongs to, you know, what social psychologists call the in-group. So in this case, it was someone who shared your racial or ethnic background. So if you're white, you are very able or willing to resonate with someone else who's white. If you're black, you're able and willing to resonate with someone else who's black. And we also had Asian groups and South Asian groups from the Indian subcontinent. And we found this, you know, this in-group out-group effect. The key here, though, is that when people looked at people who were from a different group, so when the white people looked at black people, or when, let's say, South Asian people looked at white people, or black people for that matter, we found that people were less likely to resonate with other people. So they're less likely to simulate the actions of another person when the other person was of a different racial background than oneself. And we found this to be the case for actions. So when people were kind of engaged in brain activity, as people were kind of assuming having a mental activity of resonating with other people who are, you know, doing a simple motor action. But we also found it with emotions. So when people observed other people who were, let's say, expressing some kind of distress or sadness, again, people resonated with the sadness. They kind of maybe felt a bit of sadness themselves, but typically only when that person belonged to the in-group, and much less so when that person belonged to the out-group. And as well, we also found a relationship between people's attitudes about groups, so their levels of prejudice towards various groups. And we found that levels of prejudice directly predicted the amount of, let's say, motor resonance that you showed in your brain. So the more prejudiced you were, the less you tended to mentally simulate the actions of out-group people. Now, to get back to your question, you asked how this relates to a current study. I mean, I think at this point I would be speculating because we didn't actually measure power in these studies of intergroup relations. But it's conceivable that, you know, there may be power differences between groups. Maybe another way of thinking about it is that the same process may be underlying both things. So again, in our studies with power, I was suggesting that this is a fluid process, and that really it's about a willingness or a motivation to, let's say, empathize or to get into the head of someone else. Well, maybe the same thing occurs with groups and out-groups. Maybe when I'm watching someone who's an out-group member, who maybe I don't have lots of contact with regularly, maybe I don't really have much exposure to them regularly, and maybe as well, if they are, let's say, a stigmatized group, low-status group, well, then I don't necessarily need to, let's say, pay attention to them and to get into their mind. So I'm just not willing to kind of do that, to mentally simulate the actions of these other people. So again, it speaks to a willingness. And we actually have data, it's unpublished at this point, which corroborates this idea of it being a motivated process. So in this study, what we had people do was the same kind of idea, observing in-group members and out-group members doing simple actions. In our typical study, the action is like literally lifting up a glass with water, putting it to your mouth and putting it back down. So in this follow-up study, we actually kind of added an emotional quality to these actions. So we had the neutral one, the glass up and down, but then we also had people, you know, giving a thumbs up, positive kind of maybe a joyous, like accepting kind of gesture. And then we also had people giving, this is, you know, videotaped images, people giving you the finger. I was just clearly aggressive, antisocial, threatening. And what we found is that, especially for the threatening gestures, that it doesn't matter if a person belongs to your in-group or to your out-group, you are resonating with that person. And that's because now you've got a threat in front of you, and now you're probably motivated to understand what they're going to do, what they're like, because, well, they may attack you. So it pays for you to understand what's going on, what their intentions are. You may pay especially close attention to those kinds of gestures. So this, again, speaks to this kind of idea of this being a fluid, motivated process, and this lack of resonance may be more about a lack of willingness as opposed to a lack of ability.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that empathy can be actively constructed.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I'd use the word constructed, but it certainly can be, let's say, deployed. Some people have argued the ability to kind of mind read in this way is a fundamental ability that a few other animals, if any other animals, really, really possess. So maybe some of our primate relatives may have some rudimentary forms of mentalizing or kind of getting to the heads of their conspecifics. But we have it to an exquisite degree, and it's probably what is one of the ingredients as to why our species is so successful. Some evolutionary psychologists and biologists have argued. It's maybe allowed for, you know, the formation of large coalitions of groups. And with groups, you can build societies and cities. So but all this requires, you know, an ability to get into someone's head, to trust them, to understand them. So I think we all have this ability, again, with exceptions, you know, these are going to be based on some diseases or disorders. But we all tend to have this ability. And then it's a question of whether we want to deploy it or not, whether we want to kind of use this thing or not.
Well, Michael Inslicht, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much for having me.
Michael Inslicht is a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto. He's the author of Stereotype Threat, Theory, Process, and Application. He's co-author of Power Changes How the Brain Responds to Other. And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.